Samuel L. Bronkowitz presents...
Is your website purdy?
Mind your business!
Does it work right?
Mind your business!
Can people find it?
Say it! Say it!
Mind your business!
If you answered no, or kinda, to any of these questions, you came to the right podcast, because we're going to help you mind your business. Here's your host, the lexical cognizant and SEO director guy of Mind Development and Design, Mark Boyd.
Welcome to this week's Mind Your Business podcast, presented by the Minds at Mind Development and Design, and we always like to say presented by you, because you listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher, you follow us on Pinterest, thank you very, very much, and thanks to Whiff Roasters in Lititz, Pennsylvania for existing. They're only a couple of blocks from my house, and I love their coffee. I just have to talk about it occasionally. I'm really excited about this week's podcast because I talked about this last week a little bit, just to kind of tease it. We're doing something we've totally never done before, and in doing this, the Chad Rock and I can have fun with our love of music and not do it gratuitously. There's always a method to the madness. What we're going to look at some of our favorite 70s band logos and what makes them good. Why do we like them? Why do you like them? Because you're probably going to hear some of these that you like, some of these that you don't. So we thought we'd bring it out because it would be good for your thought processes. If you're thinking about a logo for your own business, thinking about refreshing the logo you have, it's always fun to look at it from this standpoint because you think of the fact that we have, you know, how many hundreds or how many thousands of images, advertising images, that enter our minds every day. And there are certain things that stick out, certain colors that stick out. We've talked about color psychology on previous podcasts, and certain logos that just get indelibly stamped into our psyches. So we're going to talk about some of our favorite 1970s band logos and what makes them good. So Chad, welcome back, as always.
Thank you, brother. Good to be here.
Now, we've both been looking forward to this one because we both love music, and any chance to combine music with the podcast is always good stuff.
So, always good. Yes,
indeed. Always good. So we've got five logos. So we thought it would be fun to talk about it from both sides. You know, just from a fan standpoint, dude, that looks great. Why does it look great? And that's why Chad's here, because he's got the insight. So we'll start. So Chad, we're going to start at number five, right, and work our way to number one.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we can definitely start. Yeah, we can start at number five and move our way up. But I guess, you know, before we start, I think it's important to note that a couple of these logos are definitely winners. Personally, or even in my professional point of view, I don't think that they all necessarily are fantastic logos. I think that they work for certain elements and they work in their given areas, if you will. But I wouldn't say that I'm completely a fan of all of them. But, you know, obviously these logos are iconic. And when we get into this and we start talking about it, you know, as a listener, maybe kind of take a step back and realize that a lot of the recognition and a lot of the identifiable characteristics of these logos and the reason why they are so iconic is because, you know, they were designed 35 years ago or 40 years ago. You know what I mean? It's like there's been a lot of time involved, you know, and there, like you said before, like a lot of these logos are kind of ingrained in our psyche, you know, because of what we've seen and, you know, what we've grown up with. Now, there are definitely some fantastic logos, and we'll definitely get into those. But there are also some stinkers too. And there's, you know, and it's not, you know, it's not necessarily anything, you know, negative in any way. It's just like sometimes the elements come together and they're perfect and everything works. And sometimes, you know, maybe it was a little, I don't want to say half-assed, but maybe it wasn't necessarily the impact that was what they wanted to do. It kind of fell together or fell into place later, and people just kind of adopted it as a logo, so to speak.
Right. You know, it could be like the Night Ranger logo, which looks really like it would be better on the left sleeve of your Boy Scout uniform than on on an album. But I digress. We'll talk about that one on another podcast.
Exactly.
I think that was 80s. That doesn't count here.
Right.
Now, number five here, this first one, number five, Led Zeppelin. And there's a certain one of their logos, but I wanted to bring this up to you just for the heck of it.
Sure.
I almost look at Led Zeppelin as the Geico of rock bands because they have several different logos. And, you know, Geico has the gecko, but they had this, the caveman, and they've had, like, other things that they've done on their commercials as well.
Mm-hmm.
Zeppelin, they have the word logo. They have the Zeppelin itself. They have the Fallen Angel, which, of course, was, you know, what was on their record label, the Swan Song label. But it's the four symbols.
Mm-hmm.
That really seemed to stick out more than any of the others. And I know it's one of my, I mean, I love Led Zeppelin to begin with, but those four symbols, that's what I think of. When you see those symbols, to me as a fan, when you see those symbols, you know it's Led Zeppelin. But then on the other hand, when you think of Led Zeppelin, very often you think of those symbols.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. And I think that is, and I think that's why we have it at number five, you know, on this list. And essentially the concept there is while those symbols, have come to represent Led Zeppelin, they mm-hmm. aren't necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily call them Led Zeppelin logos. I would call them, symbols that they adopted for a purpose and were kind of adapted to, you know, for their use. It's quite possibly one of the most recognizable and memorable, we'll call it a series of symbols.
But what you're saying here, this is really cool. What you're saying is that's not a logo. Those are symbols that they adopted. What could be considered more of a logo for them might be, say, their name logo and
right.
the font that's written in.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. Even the the Zeppelin itself, you know, you don't necessarily see it all that often, but I would say primarily that their most recognizable logo, if you will, would be the letter mark, would be the Led Zeppelin, the text, the way that it's,
sure.
the way that it's created and drawn. Yeah. You know, as far as the four symbols go, I like to call them, you know, a series of symbols, and they're definitely one of the most recognizable and most memorable, you know, series of symbols, you could say, and I'd say in classic rock history, because even like you mentioned before, you see those symbols and it's Zeppelin, you know that, you know where it comes from, you know, it was on the albums, they've used it in a number of different places. But however, my contention is that it's not necessarily a logo in the typical sense. It represents the band as intended, but those symbols are not necessarily traditional logos. So what I'm going to end up doing here for these, you know, next couple, you know, logos that we're talking about is possibly I'm going to get into a little bit of history and see how they, you know, how it kind of came about and where certain things came from. Because honestly, you can look at it from a very superficial standpoint and say, oh, well, that's a really cool logo. That looks really awesome. But if you don't understand the elements or you don't have a concept of what's behind it, it might not necessarily make sense. And there are some things that might make sense to me in the design world because of the elements that they chose or things that they're using with their logos, with their brands, and, you know, with these, you know, these kind of symbols. So the whole issue with the symbols at this point is essentially, long story short, Zeppelin 3 got horrible reviews. They
my favorite Zeppelin album.
Hey man, it's Zeppelin. I'm not gonna mince words about it. But the critics hated it. They
did.
They tore it up. So basically, what happened was Page wanted to do something completely anonymous and completely different than anything that they had done before. So when they released what is now known as Zeppelin 4, it didn't have a title and it didn't have any information whatsoever on the cover. It was literally
nothing even on the spine of the record.
Nothing. Yeah, it was just a picture on the front, picture on the back, and you actually didn't even see these particular logos, these particular symbols. They were on the inside cover. So I think there was some confusion or something essentially that, you know, eventually they started putting stickers, you know, with the symbols and,
yes.
you know, track listings and things like that to kind of help with the sales. But that's not what that's not what the band wanted. They really kind of got sick of the way that they were treated, you know, with 3, and said, you know what, screw it. We're going to rely on our actual artistry and our music ability. We're not going to rely so much on the Led Zeppelin name. So this concept of creating these symbols essentially to represent the band members without having to use any words or any actual content, The album itself didn't really have a title. It was technically untitled, though it is known as Zeppelin IV, the fourth album, or
Zoso,
yeah, the symbol album, things of that nature. So it does have recognition in that that those icons were somewhat interpreted or adopted or adapted into being a logo or like a representation of the band. So basically what happened was they wanted to, Page had this great idea. He was like, hey, I'm going to let's come up with these with symbols. And each one of these symbols is going to represent a member of the band. So not only are there four members of the band, it was the fourth album. It kind of all kind of played together with this whole concept of no words, no titles, nothing like that. So of the four symbols that are there, at least two of them were from Rudolf Koch's book, Book of Signs. So two of them are already pretty much standard symbols, which is another reason why I don't feel that they actually fall into the logo category.
They weren't necessarily designed for Zeppelin.
Exactly. They were more chosen to be personal representations. So Page pretty much said, hey, listen, we're going to put this concept into effect. I want you guys to come up with an icon, come up with a graphic, come up with a symbol that represents you. So there are two fairly common logos or common symbols. Jesus, I did it again. Two fairly common symbols that are found in the Book of Symbols. And the one is the three circles. And the other one is the essentially what equates to be the Celtic Trinity knot type of thing. I forget what the technical term for it is, but those are common symbols. So those were chosen. But Page and Plant actually created their own symbols, though it has been noted that Plant's symbol was something that was adapted from an icon which was supposedly representing the lost continent of Mu, which is kind of like a civilization that sunk into the Pacific Ocean, similar to the way that, you know, we have stories of Atlantis. The Mu civilization was apparently in the Pacific, but befell a similar fate and fell into the ocean, blah, 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 whatever. Now, out of the four, Page's symbol, what's commonly known as the Zoso symbol, even though it's not meant to be a word at all, it was he really never even explained it, but that was probably the most original of the those particular symbols. Some say it has some occult meaning due to his interest in magic and, you know.
Well, I think he was living in Boleskine House on the shore of Loch Ness at that time, which was supposedly a haunted house. So, I mean, that it certainly, I think he was living there at that time. So that would only feed into, you know, that, you know, the mythology there.
Right. And if I'm not mistaken, I think he had some kind of stake in a bookshop that had that sold occult type material.
Yes.
Cause I had read some stuff a while back that he was kind of into Aleister Crowley a little bit. So that kind of played into
Crowley actually owned Boleskine House before. That's what I couldn't remember before Jimmy Page bought it.
There you go.
And that's where the whole haunted thing came from.
Ah, see, there we go. Okay. now it all kind of makes sense.
Yes.
But anyway, there was this big, there was a little bit of a, you know, hubbub as to whether, you know, the occult meaning was, you know, due to that, you know, due to his interest in the magic and due to, you know, what he was doing at the time or what he was interested in at the time. So there are those. I guess it really depends on how you feel about it or what you want to believe. I tend to lean on maybe it was really just his musical background coming through and doing it in kind of a creative or esoteric way to make people think, you know, that it might be something crazy. But realistically, it was that.
I think Zeppelin had a lot of fun with that back in the day.
Exactly.
I really do.
And really, that's kind of one of the things. It's almost, I don't know if we're going to get into any of the band's that also kind of had that connotation in this podcast, but there are a number of bands that really kind of played on that, and it seemed that the 70s were a really good time to kind of play on people's fears about the occult and Satan worshiping and all kinds of other bullshit that realistically it was smoke and mirrors as far as just distraction, essentially. You know what I mean? It really had nothing to do with the actual music.
And speaking of Air of Mystery and Misunderstood and all that kind of stuff, I think our number four logo is a great example of that, and that's the Grateful Dead. Chad and I both had our notes about these logos, and I like what he wrote in there. Good example of a logo that was essentially stumbled into, and I can't wait to hear about this, because the reason that Grateful Dead skull with the lightning bolt going through it, the reason that's emblazoned in my mind, it goes back to the early days of MTV, when MTV was new, and I would go over to my friend's house, and we'd stay up till 3, 4, 5 in the morning just watching videos all night long. And back then, they had concert schedules that they would roll through. Because, I mean, this was the early days of MTV. People didn't think it was going to work, so any content that they had, they used it to the hilt. So any bands that were on tour, they would have, it was like credits rolling up after a movie. They would have, in between videos or in between commercials or whatever, they would have a certain band and they would have their upcoming dates for the next couple of months going up.
Right.
And my friends and I, we had never heard the Grateful Dead, but it seemed like every time the concert schedule would come up, there would be the Grateful Dead. And we were like, man, these guys are always on tour. I've never heard of them. I've never heard them on the radio. We're in high school. We're like, I've never heard of this band, blah, blah, blah. But they're on tour all the time and people talk about them. We didn't understand. And that logo has been emblazoned in my mind because it draws back those memories of this band that, I mean, I'm now very familiar with, but this band that at the time I never heard a note they played, but I had an immediate respect for them because they had a cool logo and apparently they were doing just fine because they were playing all the time.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that you always hear about the Dead is that most bands, they always make their money touring, but the Dead toured constantly. Like they were always on the road.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it's kind of how the logo was created or how it came about all kind of revolves around their touring. Now, I will say that, I kind of like you, when I first found out about the Dead, when I first, heard them, when I first saw that logo, it was just like, to me, I was just like, oh man, like I'm a kid. I was like, that's a cool logo. It's got a skull, it's got a lightning bolt, and it's, and the elements of it were fairly basic, but you could really adopt it adapt it into a number of other things. You could put anything in that skull head. You just see the skull really, and you can identify it as Dead. However,
did you catch that? You see the skull and identify it as Dead. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Wow, that was. I'm back on that one.
That was brilliant, man.
Hey, thanks, dude.
But anyway, go ahead.
So the skull and lightning bolt logo, aka Steely, it got its first big show was to the public was on the Steal Your Face album, I think it was called. But the band had been using that for years prior, to put on their equipment and things of that nature. So basically it was two guys. It was Owsley Stanley and Bob Thomas, who kind of came together and designed this logo back in 69. And I think it was Owsley who, they were on a tour bus or he was driving, whatever it was, he basically saw a sign on the freeway and it was, half of it was orange, half of it was blue, but it was divided by a bold white line. And he couldn't necessarily remember or recall what it was, if it was a interstate sign or if it was a sign that he just saw from like a company that, that had that particular logo, but mm-hmm. that color combination and that split with the white bar separating it really kind of took hold with him. So he thought the concept of the colors worked well. He liked the color combination, thought that worked well. And then really what it kind of boiled down to was adding this lightning bolt separator, and it really all they just say it's like we just did it to look cool. Like that's all it was. It was like,
yes,
here's this logo or here's this concept. It has a lightning bolt in it. Boom, it looks cool. Now, a lot of people will point to the fact that that lightning bolt, the 13-point bolt, actually came from a stencil that the band used to ID their equipment. So, like we had said earlier, they had toured all over the place, and they were always in these gigs, and they're always going to different places. And you know, you've played in with a number of bands, and you know, you've been backstage, and everyone's equipment's back there.
Oh yeah,
they had no way to really tell, you know, like whose equipment was whose, unless someone was keeping you know a good organizational
eye on it. Absolutely.
And let's be honest, you're at a dead show. There's probably a very good possibility that no one's paying attention. The other kind of interesting part about it, or at least the thing that I thought was kind of interesting, was not only was Owsley kind of a artistic type of guy, but he was also an underground LSD cook. So there are some speculations as to
what's for dinner.
Shit, right? So there are some speculation as to why the lightning bolt has 13 points. And some say that it's the process of the 13 is the process of creating LSD, or also the others point to it's the points in, like, if you look at the LSD molecule that you can pull out 13 points or something like that. So one or the other, it really doesn't matter. It's just that, but that essentially was, you know, how that lightning bolt ended up there. It was on their equipment. They adopted it into this blue-red concept. They added the skull afterwards, but very much it was just to look cool. They didn't really have a whole lot of real idea or concept behind it. And I'd like to say, like, Steely is an example of a highly, no pun intended, identifiable and iconic logo. It does stand on its own, and it does work. It was functional for the band before it was officially adopted as their logo. And you know me, I'm a big fan of form follows function. So function is always important. So that lightning bolt being a piece, being something to identify their equipment, really kind of pushes the fact that it was a functional piece of the logo more so than just looking cool, even though it did look cool, and that's kind of why they chose it. But as a designer, that's what I see.
So number three now,
mm-hmm.
One of my favorite bands too, and they just released a new album last week.
Yes.
Motorhead.
Motorhead.
Motorhead's got a special place in my heart because I remember it was 1983 when the Another Perfect Day album came out. I was in high school. There was a place in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that me and my friends would go to buy albums because they had had the best prices on the albums, and the people in charge of their music always stocked up the good metal albums, because I mean we were metalheads, and we'd go in there and they'd have whatever was new. They had imports and all this, and I was always fascinated with Motorhead because I thought the logo looked really, really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I had never heard a note they ever played, and I remember asking the guy there, and I remember his name, and we're friends on Facebook now. His name's Stuart Feigley. And I said, "Have you ever heard Motorhead before?" And he looked at me, and he just kind of rolled his eyes. He says, "Yeah." And I said, "What do they sound like?" And he says, "The singer has absolutely no musically redeeming quality to his voice." And you know what my response was? I must hear this.
Yeah, right.
And then I found out, you know, I really dig this. This is really cool.
Right.
And I always liked the logo. And as I've gotten older, I've seen, and we were talking about this before we started recording today, I've seen as I've gotten older how bands, if you want street cred, one of the t-shirts that you must wear is a Motorhead t-shirt.
You better have a Motorhead t-shirt. Yes.
Look at the back cover of Fuel's second album. And I mean that respectfully, too. I like Fuel, but I saw that and it was like, you know what? That's street cred right there.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a Motorhead t-shirt on. I bought a Motorhead t-shirt. I've even worn it to work a couple times.
Sure have. I like that t-shirt.
So you've got the Motorhead logo, just the word Motorhead, the way it's written, and then you've got that Snaggletooth logo, that mm-hmm. just weird looking skull with the horns coming out and all.
Yeah.
And you referred to it as a perfect example of a combination mark.
Yes, yes. So along with art, talking about our logos and things of that nature, I always tend to make the differentiation or try to at least point out the differences in what is a logo. So traditionally, a combination mark would be it's a combination of a letter mark and a logo mark. So the logo mark is the visual symbol. If you think of Apple, has the apple. That apple is a logo mark. It stands on its own. Okay. Then you have letter marks. IBM is a letter mark. Okay. It stands on its own. So a combination mark is when you have two of those elements. You have a logo mark and you have a letter mark. And the reason that I like Motorhead's logo is that, like you had mentioned, it is a great example of a combination mark. You do have the cool type on the top. And you do have what is known as Snaggletooth underneath. I've also heard it referred to as the War Pig logo.
Absolutely.
So I'll throw that in here, a couple times as well. So just so we don't, get mixed up, War Pig and Snaggletooth, they're the same guy.
They're the same thing.
Yeah. So the funny thing about, Motorhead in general and about this logo is the artist that initially drew it is a guy named Joe Patango. He did it in 77 for the band's debut album. And yep. Basically, he drew this concept up, and then another guy, designer named Phil Smee, kind of turned it into a negative, and then he added the lettering, and that made the band's first album cover. Now,
sure,
Patango had worked with Lemmy. He had known Lemmy sometime before Motorhead. And the War Pig design, Snaggletooth, was essentially inspired. He says, I think it quotes it somewhere. He actually said that it's inspired by being a naturally pissed off bastard, which oddly enough not only describes Lemmy but also describes Patango himself. So figure you have two angry guys that are trying to to put a design together, try to design a logo, and it works, for that reason alone. So when Patango was developing this or designing this, he essentially looked at a bunch of different kinds of skulls, and he looked at all these skulls, and basically Snaggletooth is a combination of a gorilla, a wolf, and a dog skull. And then
is it really?
Yeah, that's kind of that.
I did not know that.
That's where he got the inspiration of it. Yeah, it's pretty badass. And then of course you have the really large boar horns that are coming out as well.
Sure.
So that's kind of where the war pig element comes in. He initially came up with the actual skull and the features of that concept, but it was Lemmy who came in and he put the helmet, the chains, the spit and the spikes, and kind of made it a little bit more metal. So it started off with Patango doing his thing to make some aggressive stuff, and then Lemmy's like, here, let me rough this up a little bit more. I'm going to add some more like metal shit to it. It's just going to be badass. So that's where – so it was kind of a collaborative effort there. So that was Snaggletooth. That was the War Pig, piece of the Motorhead logo. The other part of it was the actual text, the actual Motorhead title, and it's not only does it just kind of it has that old Englishy type feel, but it also incorporates what's known as the heavy metal umlaut, and that is
of course
yes, and that's sheerly by. But that's really by design. There's nothing. It does. You don't pronounce it any differently. But in an interview, Lemmy had said, "You just put it there to look mean." So, I mean, I think it works, you know. And it's also,
and this coming from the man who said, "If we move in next door to you, your lawn will die."
Yes,
it's one of my favorite quotes, and that goes back to probably the late 70s, early 80s. But anyway,
great. So yeah, so they have the heavy metal umlaut, and there's a couple other bands that we'll talk about in the series that also use it. It's just one of those things that he added in there for, you know, purely visual. It's the thing that I like about Motorhead's branding or their logo in general is that the War Pig logo, the combination mark, it appears on all but two of their studio albums. They've used it on everything. So it really has, you know, it basically becomes representative. It is one of the best examples of a combination mark because it's used everywhere. There are albums or there are t-shirts like where it just says Motorhead and it doesn't have Snaggletooth in it. But 9 times out of 10, they're combined. They're together. And that's, yes. and that's what really makes the solid combination mark. Like we had just said, they can be independent, but it's always more impactful and it always looks better when they're together. I think the logo works, and that's really what at the end of the day, what really matters. Could you lose a lot of detail when it gets small? Sure. Does that really matter in the big scale, in the grand scheme of things? No. Especially because it's Motorhead. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So their use of the full combination mark is what I kind of feel sets them apart from other band logos. In that, while you can just have the letter mark, the full logo, including the War Pig, is the primary visual for the band, and it's debatable again if Snaggletooth, you know, would have been used on its own, if it would have been as effective as the full mark. I personally don't think it would have been, but again, that's something that is completely up to the beholder, if you will.
Number two here. We've got two more to go. Number two, probably the original rock brand.
Yes.
You know, yep. is the Kiss logo. And I mean, I go back. So number two, yes, is Kiss.
Yeah. Sorry, Gene.
Yeah. Sorry, Gene. You're just not number one. And you know something? As I've gotten older, I mean, I grew up a Kiss fan, and I mean, I love Sebastian Bach's quote on this. There was a documentary I was watching, one of many that I've watched, and he says, at the age of 11, you know, spitting blood and breathing fire, he says, that's just cool. And that, I mean, that's the way I felt at that time. Me and all my friends, we loved Kiss. And looking back, I still enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't enjoy what they are now, but I enjoy those old days, you know, back, you know, around Alive, you know, and Love Gun and Rock and Roll Over and all that, you know, what I grew up with. And it's, and I chuckle because I enjoy it. It's one of my favorite logos. It's certainly the logo that I drew more than any other on my notebooks when I was in school. Far and away, the Kiss logo was number one. but it's the way they became a rock brand. And not everybody in the band liked it, but of course, Gene Simmons really pushed for it.
Mm-hmm.
It fascinates me because there's an author, Chuck Klosterman. I've heard him in interviews on both music and sports. He's on ESPN a lot, but he's on a lot of these music documentaries. Really smart guy and real insightful. He loves Kiss, and at the same time, he's very critical of how they've handled things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite quotes of his that plays into this whole logo thing is he said, you know, most bands wanted to be the Beatles. He says, Kiss wanted to be Coca-Cola. they'd slap their logo on anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm waiting for Gene Simmons, you know, I mean, he's in his 60s. And, you know, eventually I'm waiting for him, you know, to like maybe need to walk with a cane. And he'll look at that cane and say, you know, if we slap the Kiss logo on this, we could probably sell millions of these. Because that's just kind of what it's turned into.
Yep.
But it's such an identifiable mark.
Definitely recognizable. And you're right. It's probably one of the best marketed letter marks of all time. and here I will make the disambiguation of letter mark. We can call it a logo, but understand that Kiss, the Kiss logo, is a letter mark. So that said, from what I understand – Ace Frehley was kind of an artsy kind of guy, and as the story goes, he designed it, but it has been noted that Paul Stanley actually drew it. That it was kind of somewhat of a collaboration, that maybe Ace maybe cleaned it up and maybe balanced some stuff out, but it was kind of I do believe Paul gets some credit there.
I heard in an interview, and it was a Gene interview, he said Ace designed it, but he says Paul refined it. He put the outline around the outside of it and kind of cleaned up the lettering and made it look more uniform.
There you go. That sounds about right. and I think probably one of the most identifiable parts of the KISS logo are the S's. As the story goes, and scholars of rock and roll will point out the fact that Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley's former band called Wicked Lester used a lightning bolt in place of the S in their logo.
Did not know that, man.
Yeah.
Really?
Yep. And as the story goes, when Frehley was, I guess he was hanging out with them, or he had seen them, or he was going to the band. I had to might want to do a little bit more research on this, but essentially, the idea was that he came in and he drew, KISS over Wicked Lester, and he used a similar lightning bolt shape for the S's.
Interesting.
That's kind of where, a lot of people will point that it wasn't necessarily a happy mistake or something that just kind of came about, that it, actually the S's were almost, I don't want to call it an homage, but I wouldn't even go that far. I would just say that it was a concept that was taken, or adapted, for them from the Wicked Lester days. The interesting thing about the KISS logo is, that we see a lot of logos that are kind of tweaked here and there, or they're used for different things. They have different, they use them in different capacities, or edit them here and there for their needs. But the KISS logo is probably one of the most steady and least altered band logos that's ever been created, and really kind of speaks to its iconic nature. And the only time that it was edited, seriously edited, was for its use in Germany in the late 70s, early 80s.
You really do your homework.
Oh man, I try. Well, it's like I said, to really kind of get into it and really kind of understand the concepts, I like to get a little history. I like to see where the things come from, because, a lot of stuff, logo specifically, you got to think about it. It's not something, hey man, it's like we talked about a couple weeks ago. Like, if you want to go spend $5 and have somebody just slap some stuff together that looks cool, that's your prerogative, man. But you're missing out on what actually makes a logo, what the actual impact is, what goes into it, the thought process, everything else. Let's be honest, maybe the lightning bolt design and just the word KISS isn't necessarily the most creative, but there are some very redeeming elements of the logo. So like I said, it's been unchanged except for its use in Germany, and that was essentially those two S's are very reminiscent of the Nazi SS insignia. The band was actually accused at one point of glorifying Nazis by using that logo. So what they did was they straightened it out and kind of made regular S's for KISS's for the use in Germany. So you can actually look on it online and you can find a German version of the KISS logo, and it's still a KISS logo because the K is still there, the I is still there, but the S's look completely different. And that is because they didn't want to piss off the Germans.
And they even had to do that with their lighted sign on stage too.
Yeah.
Had to change everything.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? Hey, it's worked for them. You know what I mean? They certainly didn't want to catch any heat. Specifically, from Germany. You got a lot of metalheads in Germany. A lot of rockets.
Yeah. Nor did they want to miss out on any of those fronts.
There you go. We don't want to piss off people that might be spending money. So
right, yeah. Gene's got bills to pay.
Exactly. So
he's got a family to feed.
So it's not. So again, not only is the logo iconic in the sense that, it really hasn't changed that much except for that, but the fact that they're willing to do that in the first place, you know, kind of goes to show that maybe it was, you know, it's there wasn't a great amount of artistic. They didn't sweat over it. You know what I mean? They weren't.
Yeah.
Paul and Ace weren't freaking out. Like, oh man, we're going to be like, I got to get this logo just right. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't that kind of thing.
I don't think they ever really sweat over much.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love their music, but I don't know that too much sweat went into.
No, I think it's sign of the times. I mean, they were just like, yeah, let's just make a logo.
And
kind of like the Dead, you know what I mean? Like those dual S's, you know, the lightning bolt thing. It looks cool, you know what I mean?
It does.
And it's definitely one of the elements that I would point to as something that makes their logo visually interesting.
And it really looks dynamite on stage. That lighted sign. Boy,
yep.
From the time I was a kid, from the moment I saw that, I'm like, that is cool. And I still feel the same way.
So, you know, while the logo is highly recognizable, one could certainly make the argument that the logo's popularity is due more to the spectacle of Kiss rather than Ace and Paul's actual artistry.
It was hard choosing between number one and number two. And I mean, Kiss, because I was into them from the time I was a kid.
Yep.
But I had to give the nod, I mean, just for me, to the Stones, because even before Kiss, I knew what that lip and tongue Rolling Stones logo was.
Yep.
I knew that was the Rolling Stones. I didn't need their name behind it or anything. I see this mouth with this tongue sticking out.
So great. So great.
It is. And iconic. Iconic as can be.
And, you know, it's like we had mentioned Kiss, you know, if Kiss wins an award or wins the award for the best letter mark, the Rolling Stones absolutely win the award for the best logo mark. The actual most impactful, most iconic, most recognizable band logo mark ever created. And mm-hmm. I do believe it has even won. It's somewhere that it's been called quite possibly the greatest band logo of all time.
I was looking at stuff on the internet too when we were you know going over these logos mm-hmm. and looking and trying to decide, and I saw that and I knew it had received accolades, but it was blowing my mind because I had no idea the history behind that logo.
It's wild, man, and it's kind of like if we going back to something like the Grateful Dead logo, where you know it was initially created just to look cool. The tongue and lips logo actually takes into consideration actual thought, actual process. It's a good design top to bottom, and it has meaning. So that, and I think that's realistically ultimately why it is the best logo, and why it is has been so recognizable, and why it's obviously the music is great. Obviously, they have an amazing amazing catalog. I don't know if they would have been able to rely simply on the morals or the laurels of the logo to actually have success. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you need to be a pretty kick-ass band to promote yourself that well and to be out as long as they have and to still be touring to this day and still doing, you know, and still be completely identifiable to people that weren't even alive at the time. Like, anybody sees that logo, they know Rolling Stones. And as you know, the story of it, I believe you had actually mentioned that they had gone to a number of either it was like the record company had looked for some people or they had looked for some people and they tried to get they tried to get, you know, somebody to design this and somebody to create a logo for them. But it actually turned out that Mick went to an art school. He talked with a couple people, and he ended up talking to this guy named John Pasch. And when he was talking to him, you know, describing what they wanted, Pasch actually has said in an interview that the thing that kind of really solidified the concept was like, you know, when you're face to face with Mick Jagger, the first thing you were always aware of was the size of his lips and mouth. And you see these old. I mean, see him now. Obviously, he's still got a pretty big mouth. But you know, back in the day, you know, much skinnier. He's still skinny now. But like, really his mouth and his lips are very prominent. So that kind of that in itself, you know, it's he's the front man. Here's a logo based on quite possibly his most redeeming feature.
The most iconic mouth in history, possibly.
Yeah, you know, and there's a reason why this logo is the best. There's a reason why it works, you know, considering, you know, Mick, and, you know, he's still one of the greatest front men of all time, you know, but he also had that flair. He had that really lively nature on stage, and that logo perfectly captured
it, really,
you know,
does
him. You know, it was like that was kind of that little bit of that lighthearted nature of the logo, and you know, the you know, the lips, you know, obviously a nod to Jagger, but then Pash put in the tongue, was designed as a little bit more of a nod to the sexual connotation, and then there was also a little bit of a anti-authoritarian attitude, kind of like a
You don't like it,
yeah, exactly. So it's like, so we have these big lips, we have this tongue, and then the reason, again, I'll point to, the reason the logo works so well is because there was actual thought and meaning behind it. You know, there was an actual concept. It wasn't thrown together to look cool, nor does it find itself used in singularity along with other logos, and similar to the way that we were talking about Led Zeppelin. That is their logo. The mouth, the tongue and lips is the Rolling Stones logo. There is really no other logo. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, these guys, you know, they came out of London in the 60s, you know, with the rebellious counterculture, the youth the way it was, and it really kind of, it took hold with the audience, took hold with the youth. It's like a very in-your-face expression that captures all this, you know, all this kind of feelings that were going on, you know, and it's been steadfast ever since. It really doesn't change that much.
I mean, that logo would look good on a martini glass, and it would also look good next to somebody, you know, on the face of somebody flipping you off.
Dude, I remember seeing that logo on shot glasses before I really even knew who it was. Yeah. You know, I mean, I remember seeing lips and tongues, and I'm just like, oh, okay. And maybe that wasn't necessarily – it might not have been used in the best sense or the best, you know, way, but everybody knew that was the Rolling Stones. That's, you know, that was them. Realistically, my only criticism of the logo, and this is very, very superficial, if you will, but, you know, as it's typically viewed, it wouldn't reproduce well in black and white.
Really good point.
Yeah.
Never thought about
As most designers know, red prints is black when you do black and white. And you can actually see a couple examples of it online. Someone has done a black-white version to kind of point that out. And I will mention that while you can identify it as the Rolling Stones logo simply by the shape,
it doesn't have the same impact.
Yeah, the color combination is quite possibly the only perceived flaw that I would that I would say. And
very interesting.
And again, in the grand scheme of things, their history, the way it's been used, I mean, how many times are you going to see a black and white Rolling Stones logo?
True.
Never. You know what I mean? And there's a good reason for that, but it's completely. It's pointless. It's a moot point.
Indeed.
So I could point out, like, some of these logos, you know, maybe like all of them so far, they really don't have any what in the design world we call just Gestalt principles. And Gestalt principles are things that we use in design to make a design more impactful. So uses of certain shapes, repetition, closure, you know, all these kind of things. You really don't see that a lot in rock logos as it is. But that's not something that I would say is you know, a detriment to the logo itself.
Now, to kind of wrap things up, I need your help in solving this, I guess you could say, a cognitive dilemma that I have.
Okay.
The Rolling Stones logo. Do you remember what year that was designed? Was that like 68 or 69? Or was it like 70?
71.
So 1971. My understanding is that the band paid this designer who, again, my understanding was the designer was a student at the time, paid him £50, and they liked the logo so much that they gave him an extra £200. My question is, that was 1971. and they paid more than $5 for a logo.
To a student, no less.
Am I off base with that? Or or do the Stones make a good point for us when it comes to logos?
The Stones make a fantastic point when it comes to logos. That's, I mean, that you really kind of hit the nail on the head there.
50 pounds back then was a good amount of
absolutely
money. Absolutely. In 71. And then to think that they basically tipped the designer four times mm-hmm. that, it's like, I will put that on to everybody who's listening to the podcast right now. If you're thinking about your logo, and granted, you may have restrictions in your budget, and that's fine, but don't use your money wisely. Mm-hmm. When it comes right down to it, use your money wisely. Know what you can afford. If you can't afford to get a professional now, sock some money away. You know, what's stopping you from doing that? Because at the end of the day, do you want an identifying mark? Mm-hmm.
Do you want to be the Rolling Stones, or do you want to be the Grateful Dead?
To be Night Ranger.
Or, Night Ranger. You want to be Night Ranger? I would say, you know, in this example, I mean, well, I was thinking about that as I was saying, I was like, do you want to be the Rolling Stones, or want to be the Grateful Dead? And I'm like, well, dude, there's probably a lot of people that would want to be the Grateful Dead. So,
absolutely. But
I'm not gonna put that past anybody. But as far as the significance and the stature that those brands, those logos bring. Be the Stones, man. Be the Stones.
Be the Stones. That is Zen Master Chad Rock's advice to you for now for your logos. Chad, as always, thank you for taking the time to do this. This was a lot of fun. And I know I learned a lot. I know our listeners learned a lot from this.
I hope
too.
So. I mean, and you know, I think this was definitely a lot of fun. And I really enjoy being able to kind of talk about, you know, what we do, you know, on a day to day basis, or at least relate it to, you know, things that we're also passionate about. And I know that, you know, we use a lot of musical references in our site. And, you know, obviously throughout the office, you know, we do have quite an eclectic group when it comes to musical taste. So, you know,
although Andy blew me away the other day, he was jamming to Fear Factory. I would have never thought that Andy would have been listening to Fear Factory, but there he was, and full volume too. Gotta say, hats off
indeed. Hats off and caffeine fueled, man. That's yes. How he does it. But no, man, thank you very much. It was definitely fun to talk about. And you know, as you know, like we said, you know, earlier, I think this could potentially turn into something regular. You know, obviously anybody that's listening, you know, feel free to let us know what you think. If you'd like to hear a little bit more, you know, things of this nature, like different kinds of our views or, you know, on the logos and how they work. Hell, even, you know, send a couple in and say, well, you know, hey, what do you guys think of this?
Well, thank you all for listening. Thanks for listening to us on iTunes and Stitcher, for following us on Pinterest as well. And we will definitely be revisiting these logos again in the near future. We look forward to seeing you next week.
From the minds at Mind Development and Design, thank you for joining us today. Until next week, make sure you mind your business.
The Samuel L. Bronkowitz Production.